Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. This Saturday, November 11th, Armistice Day, is the 99th anniversary of the end of the First World War. As part of that celebration, we'll hear a talk by Tony Foreman, a history Ph.D. student at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln and advisee of Professor Gerald Steinacher. He'll speak on the topic Karl Hans Lodi, World War I German spy and Nebraska immigrant. This program, presented as part of the recent Top Secret, Licensed to Spy exhibit at the Durham Museum, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, August 15, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Carrie Meyer, Director of Curatorial and Education Services at the Durham Museum.
What is it really like to be a spy? Is it really like the movies and TV shows that enthrall us all? Tonight's lecture will give us a glimpse of the world of real-life espionage during the First World War. Through the story of Karl Hans Lodi, a native German, we will travel from Germany to Nebraska to Britain and uncover his unique story of romance, heartbreak, espionage, folly, heroism, and cruelty. Our storyteller this evening is Tony Foreman. Tony is a native Nebraskan, history PhD student at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, and advisee of Professor Gerald Steinacher. His research interests include modern German history, European immigration to America, the Holocaust, German military honor codes, and espionage history. As a recipient of the Othmer Fellowship for Exceptional Scholars and the Christian Lighting Fellowship, Tony has conducted original research in German, British, and Nebraskan archives. The case of German spy Karl Hans Lodi will represent a chapter in his upcoming dissertation on the role of honor codes in military courtrooms. Please welcome Mr. Tony Foreman.
Thank you all. I want to thank the Durham Museum for the invitation to be here with you tonight. This turnout is awesome. I want to thank Carrie in particular for inviting me. And I also want to put you at ease. I know she mentioned that this case study, this story, is going to be part of a dissertation. I'm not going academic tonight. Don't worry. I hope you do learn something, but this is going to be more of a storytelling, like Carrie said, a storytelling. I think the story itself is going to be entertaining enough. Let me begin with a quote to set the scene for the story of Karl Hans Lodi. This is when he was being led in through the Tower of London to his execution in 1914. The prisoner walked steadily, stiffly upright, and as yet easily and unconcernedly as though he was going to a tea party instead of his own death. His eyes were turned up to the gloomy skies and his nostrils eagerly sank in the precious air that was so soon to be denied him. When I think of Karl Lodi, a phrase always slips into my head, just three little words: a gentleman, unafraid. He paid cheerfully and unresentfully, dying as he had lived, as a good man and a hero. Karl Hans Lodi was a German spy in World War I operating in Britain, and those words were spoken by the warder of the Tower of London, a British soldier. Who was Karl Hans Lodi? And how did he pull off such a, let's say, parlor trick? How did he get British soldiers to think that Karl Hans Lodi was a heroic figure? Espionage in World War I, if you were a spy, you were either a scoundrel, you were a criminal, but you were not respected. And if you were a German during World War I, the British didn't like you. But Karl Hans Lodi, he was liked by everybody. He was liked by the British. He was liked by the Germans, of course. He was also liked by the German Americans in Nebraska. So there's lots of questions, and also something that's probably on everybody's mind: what the heck was he doing in Nebraska? In Omaha, Nebraska? A German spy. So these are just some of the questions that I hope to answer in the next hour or so. So just a little bit of background first on Karl Hans Lodi. Lodi was born, it's important to be born, in 1877 in a Germany that was just politically united 5 or 6 years ago. He was raised in an oppression family. What that means is there's a lots of different German states, a lot of different German ethos, but if you were Prussian, you were steeped in the traditions of military honor and military heroics, service to the fatherland. And he was imbued with these ideals from a very young age. In fact, his father was an assessor in Berlin where he was born. He had heard stories about how his grandfather held a fortress against Napoleon. Unfortunately, Lodi's fortunes took a deep dive soon. He became orphaned. Both of his parents died. He had three sisters and a brother. They were scattered amongst each other. But he did manage to graduate grammar school by the age of 14, a typical age at that time. He got an apprenticeship at a grocery store. Pretty boring for him. Karl Hans Lodi wanted adventure. And this is going to be something that's going to be a key motivating factor for him throughout his life. So after he threw down the apron from the grocery store, he hit the high seas and became what was called a cabin boy at the age of 14. Worked himself up in the seamen's ranks. Was a cabin boy on the ship the Sirius. It's in the Lübeck Harbor today. But that's the ship that he would sail on. He's always been trying to be a hero, and he actually literally does become one. A mother and a child were thrown overboard. He dived in and saved them. And from the United States of America, he received the life-saving medal. And this is one of his key driving forces. He loved that adulation. After that, he was striving for even more honor. And he joined the Imperial Navy, completed 2 years of military service then. He was about to become a captain in the Imperial Navy, but because of an injury, a typhoid attack, he was no longer good for any fighting service. This is according to his court-martial documents later on. So here's where the story becomes more interesting, I believe. He becomes a tour guide on a cruise ship liners. There were liners called the Hamburg America Line of liners, where rich clientele would sail around the world. If you can imagine the same clientele that would be on his ship, which was the Cleveland, or the Cleveland Steamer, which is where that name comes from. But it's a sister ship of his. It is on this cruise ship where his eye gets drawn to a certain someone. Louise Storrs was a 21-year-old beauty from Nebraska. And she was known to turn heads. She was also known to be the daughter of Gottlieb Storrs, of the highly successful Storrs Brewery here in Omaha, Nebraska. Here is when Lodi showed his other talent, his talent for ingratiating himself. He was a very pleasing character, easy with conversation, a schmoozer, or what I might call a con man. Because she was good looking, she was charming, he was extremely charming, and she had money. Believe it or not, this romance on the high seas, within 2 months of this round the world trip, they were engaged to be married. Yeah, I wish I had that kind of game. And so by the time they got back, Louise Storrs returns to Omaha, Nebraska, to thundering applause, if you will, celebrating the nuptials that were about to happen. She was going to get married to this mysterious man from the high seas, from the fatherland. And German-American Nebraska was celebrating this. In the meantime, Lodi was going to tie up loose ends. So for the sake of time, and again, one of my areas of research is the German-American experience in Nebraska. I'm just going to go over this really quickly. And probably a lot of you, since you go to museums, you know, you're smarter than the average cookie, you know some of this stuff already. But the average immigrant into Nebraska, if you were German, there's going to be some opportunities for you. But they're not going to be great. They're going to be low-paying. They're going to be hard work conditions. But several lines of work would have been available to Karl Hans Lodi. One of them, since we're at the Durham Museum right now, is Union Pacific Railroad. apparently about 14% of the workforce at the Union Pacific Railroad were direct German immigrants. And there's some other opportunities. These are the Union stockyards, Jobbers Canyon, where a lot of the manufacturing jobs would have been. And also there was a deep, rich culture of German Americans in Omaha, Nebraska, and around Nebraska for that matter. There were singing clubs, beer gardens. There were German language newspapers all over the place. This was a thriving, robust culture, which you may know thrived until about 1917. And that's, of course, when the United States entered the war. But this is the environment that Karl Hans Lodi would be entering. Although he would be entering on top of the world. Some of you may know some of the stores' story, if you will. Gottlieb Storrs is actually a direct immigrant from Germany, also the Kingdom of Württemberg, not too far from the hometown of Lodi in Nordhausen, Germany. But he immigrated at the age of 20, worked himself up as a Braumeister, and bought a brewery here in Nebraska in 1884, renamed it the Storrs Brewery, and by 1892, they had 12 train carloads of beer shipped out of Omaha every day. There's 140,000 barrels of beer on the wall. I just don't have that. How about that? So they were very successful. Gottlieb Storrs was also a leading political figure, and not just a business figure, in Omaha. So I don't want to belabor that point too much, but the Storrs family was very influential. One of the things that still exists from the Storrs family is the Storrs Mansion. And I believe we have the current owners of the Storrs Mansion somewhere in the room tonight. I'm not going to reveal their identity. You know, we're talking about spies here. But this was a 27-room mansion. It's a beautiful place. And this is actually where Louise and Lodi are going to have their wedding. And you can still see it. It's out there on Farnham Street right now. So I also wanted to make one point. When I started this project, there was next to no information about what Karl Hans Lodi was doing in Nebraska. The only thing that I could ever read about it was just said, Lodi married a girl from Nebraska. It was a clandestine marriage, and it seems that he was an unsuitable candidate. So he left. I have to tell you, that is wholly inaccurate. When Louise Storrs came back home and told him that I've found the love of my life, Karl Hans Lodi, you got to meet him. He's a German. He's from Nordhausen. He's a tour guide. The Storrs family really liked him. And again, I call him a con man. He is going to ingratiate himself to everyone. And the reason I say this is one of the things that happened is future father-in-law, Gottlieb Storrs, would actually help him secure employment at the Union Pacific Railroad, right here, a management position. But he didn't have any experience in this position, so it was only with the help of his powerful father-in-law. After that, Louise was being hosted as the guest of honor at numerous parties. It was going to be the social event of the year, the wedding of the year. If you look back through the newspaper articles there, they were toasting the Triumph Storrs beer to her everywhere they went. This was going to be a big event. So by the time Lodi got there, he secured employment very quickly at the Union Pacific Railroad, also secured their first home at the Clarinda. Yeah, I can tell that some of you know where that is also. Clarinda is a Georgian Revival architecture. I don't know architecture, but that's impressive, I guess. But it was a luxury apartment, and it's only 7 blocks away from the Storrs Mansion, I believe, also on Farnham Street. So they were going to be set up very, very well. And then the Storrs Mansion is where the wedding would take place. The ballroom that would have been used at the time. This is the Adele and Fred Astaire Ballroom. At least it was known as that back then. Leaders of society, leaders of the broader society and the German-American society were there. There were newspaper men and women, elegantly dressed ladies. This was a big deal, and they were all toasting to this great union. So that's the end of the story, right? Happily ever after, nothing else happened. Well, they got married on October 29th, exactly 2 months later, on December 29th. Lodi raised his hand to Louise Storrs. He hit her, bruised her, and beat her like a dog. 3 days later, he lashed out again. And to the credit of Louise Storrs, and this is a time of inequitable marriage justice, she filed for divorce. Her gallant, dashing husband had suddenly turned into a brutish wife-beating monster. He had revealed his true character, and Louise was not going to put up with it anymore. So she petitioned for the divorce. Lodi and his lawyer vigorously denied all the charges, but by then, Lodi had already fled back to Germany. Now, as a historian, you have to try to get into people's minds what was motivating him at this time. The same papers, 2 months before, that were celebrating him as some gallant, chivalrous gentleman, and this marriage that was going to be the social event of the year, those same newspapers were now reporting that he beat his wife, he's a monster, he's ruined the life of one of our one of the daughters of Gottlieb Storrs. So he was going to try to defend his honor or what was left of it as best as he could. The Storrs family, on the other hand, saw that he went back to Germany. He got a job again with the Hamburg America Cruise Line. They thought that they were done with him forever. The time would just tick down on a divorce decree and it would be over. Lodi comes back. Right before the divorce decree is about to expire, he comes directly from Berlin with his lawyer on November 1st, 1913. My birthday, by the way. Well, not the 1913 part. But he comes back with his lawyer to contest his innocence. Louise Storrs, on the other hand, does not want to face him again. She thought that she was done with her abusive husband, soon to be ex-husband. She didn't want to face him. She doesn't go through with the divorce. And this is some of the information I garnered from the Douglas County court office. Behind the scenes, however, after Lodi goes back to Germany thinking that he had won and was going to stay married to Louise Storrs, Gottlieb Storrs, with Lodi's lawyer, decide we'll give him $10,000. Just get him away from the family. Give Louise the divorce. We'll be done with him. Wash your hands. Which is apparently what happened. $10,000 back in 1913 is about $200,000 today. So the best of my conclusions as a historian is Gottlieb Storrs paid off Lodi, the abusive husband, to get out of their lives. This now is May of 1914, and Karl Hans Lodi is looking for something to do with his life. He's got plenty of money. He does have some nefarious stories following him. He wants to do something that's going to restore his honor, restore his reputation. Fortunately for him, it's May 1914 in Europe, and of course, what is going on there? War clouds are gathering, a chance to be a hero. Karl Hans Lodi actually fit into a lot of a large group of people that was motivated by what's called the spirit of 1914. A lot of historians use that term, the spirit of 1914. This referred to war enthusiasm. A lot of young men in particular thought of war as a chance to get out of their dead-end job or get over a relationship or just do something that had some meaning. Karl Hans Lodi definitely fit into this category. So, leaving out some of the details here, Lodi did have a lot of connections to German military intelligence due to his connections in the German Imperial Navy. So he was already identified as a possible German agent. And in a lot of ways, it made a lot of sense that he would be. He had knowledge of a lot of naval matters. He was also ingratiating. And something I haven't mentioned yet, he spoke fluent English with an American accent. In fact, he fit in very well here in Nebraska as a Nebraska native. So he was not without talent, for sure. So what they wanted him to do is go to Britain, spy in Britain, report back on fleet movements and things that were overhauling, and seeing what ships might have been sunk in any battles that were going to happen. What had happened, and we're talking about spies here, so I think you're going to like this story. On August 4th, 1914, the British counterintelligence, which had just started a few years prior, it was the predecessor to what became MI5, rounded up 21 German spies that were working in Britain, decimating the German spy effort there. It was every spy, according to historians, it was every spy that Germany had in Britain. They were decimated. Kaiser Wilhelm II, who was not a very constant person anyway, was freaking out here. They said, I can't believe it. We have no intelligence about Britain. We get some people there. Well, here's Karl Hanslode, who had just dropped in their laps, fluent in English. Let's say that he's an American tourist touring in Europe and just trying to get a passage back to the United States. That's what his cover address was. It's still a little unclear whether he got a passport that he stole from an American tourist or if the German Foreign Office stole him a passport. Nonetheless, he did procure an actual passport in the name of Charles Inglis, which would be his alias when he is in Germany. So what happens here is he sails from Germany through Denmark into Norway and lands in the Firth of Forth. If you know the geography of Britain, the Firth of Forth is a deep water harbor. A lot of the German naval bases will dock there. They'll be outfitting. Very important. The other thing that was happening when it came to war is that both Germany and Britain thought this war isn't going to last very long. Actually, every nation thought this war wasn't going to last this long. The prediction game, how about that? They thought there was going to be one huge sea battle in the North Sea between Germany and Britain. And that battle's going to last maybe 1 or 2 days, and it's going to be over. The war, at least in the sea, is going to be over. But Germany can't win that war if they don't know where the British ships are. So that's what Lodi was sent to do. And now we get more into what he actually did as a spy. So Karl-Hans Lodi was set up with a contact in Stockholm, Sweden, a neutral country. This was used very frequently, that they would pass telegrams for an agent working in an enemy territory. They would pass it to a neutral country and then pass it on to Germany in this case. To his Stockholm contact, his first letter of August 30th, 1914. He had arrived just 3 days earlier. Karl-Hans Lodi, or a.k.a. Charles Inglis, would write, "Must cancel. Johnson very ill. Last 4 days. Shall leave shortly." Pretty, you know, boring letter. What that actually meant was, last 4 days means that four battleships are overhauling at the Firth of Forth. Shall leave shortly, of course, means they are going to leave shortly. This telegram was transmitted by Karl-Hans Lodi to his Stockholm, Sweden contact. This is August 30th. On September 5th, 1914, the HMS Pathfinder became the first ship ever in history to be torpedoed by a self-propelled submarine torpedo. And that hearkened in the age of submarine warfare to the consternation of the Royal Navy and the First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill. The reason I want to bring that up is I wanted to kind of set the record straight. A lot of stuff that's been written about Karl-Hans Lodi was that he wasn't a very good spy. Didn't cover his tracks very well. And that is very true, as we'll see very soon. He wasn't very discriminant about what information he sent on. But I believe, to the best of the information, that in this telegram, the information he sent on cost lives, and it did send that Pathfinder down to the bottom of the ocean. So Lodi might not have been the best spy, didn't cover his tracks, but the information he did send back was very, very sensitive. Now, what Lodi didn't know, unfortunately for him, was that MI5 had had his Stockholm contact on their radar for months. They had already figured out that the Stockholm contact was indeed a German agent. And I'm going to read something that one of the censors wrote later on, who was working for MI5 in the Lettered Interception Unit in London, when they were being trained. Several names were written on a large blackboard which hung on the wall, plainly visible, and we had to keep a sharp lookout for any mention of these letters we read. The names were those of persons suspected of sending information to Germany via neutral countries. In other words, his Stockholm contact. In addition, a short sentence was scribbled up on this board. Johnson is ill. Uh-oh. The Admiralty knew that somewhere in Britain a German officer was traveling about who intended to use this formulary to convey the news of certain movements of the British fleet. So, blissfully ignorant of this information, Karl Hans Lodi, a.k.a. Charles Inglis, was already on his radar, on their radar from the get-go. And Lodi would continue to send messages to his Stockholm contact without knowing this. Now, this first telegram did go through to the German high command. We know that. It was only after the fact that they saw that Charles Inglis wrote Johnson very ill. And the people at MI5, their antenna went up and said, this is another German spy. They let him continue to operate without finding him right away, because, as you can imagine, they wanted to find out more information. Maybe this Charles Inglis will send more information, and we'll be able to find more German spies. As long as he doesn't send anything too damaging. Well, in the immediate time after that, it was actually almost comical what he sent. This is the actual letter he sent to his Stockholm contact, where he's relaying a rumor that 60,000 Russians with snow still on their boots had landed in Scotland and were marching down to London and were going to join the Western Front in France and fight with the French and the British. Now, the MI5 decided, that's okay, send that through. Maybe the Germans will believe it. They're not as sophisticated with intelligence as us. So they kept on sending those letters. It wasn't until, however, he sent a letter. He started to get really nervous, by the way, in Edinburgh, which is where he close to the Firth of Forth. Spy mania was all over the place in Britain. He did have an American accent, but every now and then the people that he was boarding with for 3 weeks were asking him, so when are you going back to the United States anyway? I mean, you're just kind of bicycling around here for a while. And other times they'd say, you know, your accent seems more German than American. And that, of course, is frightening to Karl Hans Lodi. So he decides to change the scene a little bit. He decides to go to Dublin. On his way to Dublin, he stops at the Liverpool harbor. This is going to be in September of 1914. Lodi goes to Liverpool, sends back information about the outfitting of the Aquitania and the Lusitania. He reports some rumors that there might be gun turrets on the Lusitania, rumors that there might be war material being hauled on the Lusitania. And for the sake of time, I'm not going to go too deep into that issue. It's a big issue, but there are reasons why the Germans would want to know if that's the case. They had ships like the Lusitania on their radar, because they thought that the Allies were using them to ship war materials, in which case those cruise ships were fair game to sink. And of course, as we know, in May of 1915, only a few months after the Germans did indeed sink the Lusitania. At this point, however, MI5 noticed this information that Lodi was sending back, and they decided, this man is too dangerous, this information, if it gets out, we could lose thousands of people, which of course they did eventually. 128 Americans go down in the Lusitania. So they decide that they got to find this Charles Inglis, and fast. And you got to hand it to the British. They at this time are more sophisticated than any other nation when it came to espionage. In fact, one of the things at the Spy Museum, Sir Francis Walsingham was one of the spies that you could pick on at the end. He, to a lot of historians, is known as the father of espionage, or the great spy master. This is way back in the Elizabethan times, Elizabeth I. So they were light years ahead of the Germans when it came to espionage. So they round him up within one day. They track him down. And when they catch him, he finally kind of loses his cool, and all of a sudden his German accent starts to slip, and he says, "Now take care, I'm an American citizen." They take him up to his room, and they find a cipher. They find 14 pounds in German gold. They find a notebook detailing British ships lost in the North Sea. And then also they find a tailored suit that said it was from a clothier's from Berlin in May of 1914 with the name Karl Hans Lodi sewn in it. So the guy was not exactly James Bond level. But nonetheless, because of all of this evidence, Lodi at this time knows that his goose is cooked. They have so much evidence. What's he going to do? He's going to get court-martialed, and he's probably going to be put to death. At this time in Britain, there was what's called the Defense of the Realm Act. Any espionage that's being performed in Britain against them is going to get the death penalty. But there is a chance that if he gives up enough information about his sources and his handlers, that he could bargain for his life. So it was a stark choice. But what we know about Karl Hans Lodi, it was an easy choice to make. He chose to play the honorable gentleman. He chose to become a heroic figure to both Britain and Germany. And that indeed is the choice that he decides. American newspapers, British newspapers were allowed into this courtroom. It was not a regular court-martial. It was performed in the High Court. He was kept in the Tower of London, a tower that is usually just held for important political prisoners throughout the ages, but they put Karl Hans Lodi there. Again, stylishly dressed ladies, all the leaders of society, and they were reporting all the news of this. And it did go, practically worldwide, at least in the Western world, and it got back to a place, Omaha, Nebraska. And in fact, the newspapers caught hold that a person named Karl Hans Lodi was now a German spy. And they interviewed Louise Storrs about, like, is this the person that you were married to? Is this the person that abused you? And Louise Storrs, paraphrasing here, is like, I do not know if this is the Karl Hans Lodi. Last I heard, he was on a cruise ship in the North Sea. I don't even know if this is the same man. In the same way with the Storrs family, that was their response. Why do they respond that way? Well, first of all, privately, he was a despised wife beater. They thought that they were done with him. They wouldn't hear about him anymore. They paid him money and he left. Publicly, German-American Omaha would not welcome news that there was an actual German spy among them. This time of high anti-German sentiment, not just in Britain, but in America at this time, which would, of course, boil up over the years as World War I would progress and America would actually enter the war. But there was always a lot of skepticism on the part of what I guess you could call Anglo-America, the dominant culture at the time. Were the Germans, did they have dual allegiance? Were they more loyal to the United States of America, or are they more loyal to their cultural homeland in the German states? And so to have this news that Karl Hans Lodi was actually a German spy, you can imagine the hysteria that this was going to cause. While that news was filtering into Omaha, Karl-Heinz Lodi played his best card, and he was, oh my gosh, again, con man. Yeah, he was very good at spinning his own story. He said that he did not volunteer for spying. Again, spying was a despised profession. It was for criminals, for scoundrels. And I, Karl-Heinz Lodi is saying, I did not receive any payment to do this. I did this for my country. I did this because I can't fight physically. This is something that I could do. I didn't want to do it, didn't take payment. I did it for my nation. The facts are, of course, different than that. Karl-Heinz Lodi enthusiastically volunteered to be a spy. This was his big chance to make something big. His orders were to go spy on the British ships. Germany would win that naval war real quick. They'd win the Fuller War real quick. They'd come back to Central Powers, and Lodi would have probably a job in the military, if not in the German intelligence. And if he had to keep his exploits secret, at least the higher-ups would appreciate what he had done. So there were a lot of personal reasons for what he did, not just nationalistic or some higher value. But again, the truth is very different than how Karl-Heinz Lodi propelled himself. So what happens? There's lots of evidence. I could go on for an hour about the adulation that the British gave to Karl-Heinz Lodi. They would eventually give him his own grave, separate from all the other German spies and German soldiers that had been killed around the British territory. There were thousands of British soldiers who died in World War I who never received a grave at all. In other words, they gave Karl-Heinz Lodi, a German spy, more honor or more honorific burials than their own soldiers. So Lodi was very good at what he did. In the last days of his trial, I should say that he was going to be put to death. He admitted everything that he did. That's one of the reasons that they respected him so much. But they were going to put him to death in a very different way than spies are usually put to death. Spies are hanged. If you hang somebody in this ethos that they were in, that means you were a dishonorable scoundrel. Karl-Heinz Lodi was afforded a firing squad of fellow officers, the way that you would kill another honorable officer. This was done for centuries. He was also going to be executed in the Tower of London, the first execution in over 150 years. So, in the waning days, he continued to write his own story, take it up a notch, if you will. To his relatives in Stuttgart, this was just a couple days before he was going to be executed. I die here in the enemy's country, silent and unknown, despite all the press I was in the court-martial. But the consciousness that I die in the service of the fatherland makes death easy. To a friend in Omaha, Nebraska, he writes, my feelings run riot when I can permit myself to review the dramatic events of the last 3 years and what is to be the probable climax of it all. You may have an opportunity to say a word to some of those whom I feel an interest. Ask them to judge me not harshly. His reputation among the people he left in Nebraska seemed to also be foremost on his mind in his last days. According to the head of British Criminal Division, Sir Basil Thompson, a wedding ring he left was to be forwarded to a lady in Nebraska, and it was duly transmitted. So on a cold and foggy morning on November 6, 1914, Lodi steeled himself to accept his ultimate fate. One incident, the provost marshal, he asked, I don't suppose you would care to shake the hand of a German spy. And that marshal said, no, but I will shake the hand of a brave man. So it was almost unanimous what they thought of Karl-Heinz Lodi. And so the yeoman warder of the Tower of London, the second quote I'm going to use from him because he's flowery, you know, he He writes like a real British person. As he's being led away, the calmest and most composed member of the execution party was the condemned man himself. Then came a queer and pathetic little incident. As they came to the end of the veranda, the chaplain, in his nervousness, made a turn to the left, which was the wrong way. Instantly, Lodi took a quick step forward, caught the chaplain by the right arm, and with a polite and kindly smile, gently guided him to the right, the correct way. A few moments later, the procession disappeared through the doorway of a sinister shed, and shortly after that came the muffled sound of a single volley. Carl Lodi had paid. So what became of the principal characters in this story? Well, Louise Storrs got on with her life after Carl Hans Lodi's execution. He would not be coming back anymore now. She would marry Earl Buck in 1916. They'd have a son, and she would live to be in her 80s. We don't know, or I haven't found evidence, whether she actually received the wedding ring from Carl Hans Lodi or if she would have accepted it. What we can assume is that she did her best to get on with her life. The Storrs Brewery survived Prohibition. Yay! They sold ice and near beer, which sounds awful, but they did it anyway. And by 1934, they were up and running again. They were forced out of business in 1972 by the mega brewers. But many of you probably do know that Storrs beer is now being brewed again. It's a different family, a different group that's doing it, but that Storrs label is on there again. So go out, check them out. Okay, I'm not a paid spokesperson. I've tried it. It's very good. And the Storrs mansion, again, is still standing. It's being, I understand, restored at this current time, and it's on the National Register of Historical Places. As for Carl Hans Lodi, well, he was going to achieve in death what he never actually was in life. He might have thought that he was having an effect in the court-martial, that people were starting to think of him as a hero and honorable. But after his death, they renamed a street that he was brought up in, which is, this street was renamed Carl Hans Lodi Straße in 1933 by the Nazis. He would receive the Iron Cross after his death from the Kaiser. He would have a destroyer named after him that sailed out of the Hans Lodi destroyer, which would be active during World War II. There are so many examples of what the Nazis would do with the image of Carl Hans Lodi, which might seem a little anachronistic. If you think about it, the National Socialists were not going to be actually a party of what we would recognize until the very early 20s, or 1919, if you will. So what does Carl Hans Lodi have to do with that? Well, the Nazis were very good at appropriating any ethos, any feeling that they thought was going to help their cause. One of that was like extreme nationalism. Carl Hans Lodi, his story, as it was told, was someone who gave up his entire life, made the ultimate sacrifice for his nation. And that's exactly what the National Socialists were going to expect from everyone, from the entire German nation. So they want to elevate people like Carl Hans Lodi to show the German people and the German men exactly what they're supposed to do for their new Führer. In one of the many pieces of propaganda that was out at the time, "A new era has dawned," it read, "for Germany, awakened by its great leader Adolf Hitler. With renewed enthusiasm and reflection on ideal values, the German people should honor and thank the names of its heroes. And in the number of German heroes who have become commonplace to all the people is heard the name Carl Hans Lodi." The piece, this propaganda book, would go on to describe how Lodi was not a paid agent, and he did everything free, and he did it for his country. "You, the German youth," it would conclude, "do not forget the German hero Carl Hans Lodi. Keep his memory and carry in your heart his legacy. Alles für Deutschland." On the 20th anniversary, this would be 1934, of Karlheinz Lodi's death in the Lübeck castle and the entryway into Lübeck. They install a monument to him. You can see a knight in armor standing on a snake. The snake actually is a symbol for deceit, since he was a German spy, but he was an honorable German spy. And this is kind of where I'm going to end the talk with this particular thing. I'm not done yet. But this will be the last item, because I think this says a lot about what actually has happened to the image of Karlheinz Lodi. In 1946, shortly after Germany surrendered, the city council in Lübeck decided to strike this monument, get rid of it, get rid of Karlheinz Lodi. He's a symbol of Nazism now. The British were the occupying force there, and it was the British, ironically, who said, "Why are you getting rid of a World War I hero?" It was like, "We all know him. Yeah, Karlheinz Lodi. He was that guy who came over here and, you know, fought for his country. That's what you guys should stand for. Don't strike the whole thing. If you want to take it down, go ahead and take part of it down. But leave up that plaque that says, Karlheinz Lodi starb für uns. Karlheinz Lodi died for us in the Tower of London." So they were convinced by the British, nonetheless, to leave it up there. In 2009, they decided to put up a plaque. They decided, well, maybe we should put up a plaque explaining exactly what's going on here. And I can tell you, when I visited the place, I would be watching people walking around. A lot of them were Germans. They'd walk up here and it's like, "Who the heck is this guy?" And then they would read this plaque here. And just to paraphrase what it says in German, is that Karlheinz Lodi, this thing was put here. He was a World War I spy, but it was put here as a piece of propaganda. Why did they do that? Because ever since then, the city of Lübeck has been pestered with neo-Nazis. So today, the city of Lübeck has a problem because of his image, even though he wasn't a Nazi. In other words, Lodi is no longer a heroic figure, an honorable figure in Germany or Britain, German-American Nebraska. And in fact, if his true character were known, he never would have been. In his last full day of life, he did write down one other comment. "Maybe some historian will record me among the despised class of war victims." Well, it's taken one century. All right, I thank you.
All right. Well, we have some time for questions. Do raise your hand. We'll bring a mic to you. This is being recorded, so if you could wait with your question until we get to the mic to you, we'd really appreciate it.
I think it's a simple question. Well, a couple simple questions. Did you say he was born in Nordholz?
Nordhausen.
Where's that at?
It's in Thuringia.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the other thing was, you have the telegram and the letter. Where did you get those from, and why wouldn't they have been destroyed, at least the telegram?
Oh, yeah, well, the telegram, those images are from the UK National Archives. A lot of my documents come from the court-martial documents, and that, again, is at the UK National Archives. The telegram, they just kept that. And that's a great question about not everything from MI5 or MI6 in intelligence actually is ever released to the public. But those documents were, it might have been because it's over a century old, but yeah, finding little documents like that is just thrilling as a historian, if you will. You know. I mean, being a historian is like being Indiana Jones without the snakes, you know? You're finding cool stuff, so.
The fact that he was court-martialed suggested he was still in the military.
Yes, I guess I didn't mention that. He was in the reserves, in the Imperial Navy reserves, yes. Mm-hmm. He was still a commissioned officer.
I see you have a picture of the tombstone there. I was recently in Germany, and I was told that Graves are only there for 40 years, so I'm surprised that there's a tombstone.
According to what I know, the family has been kind of maintaining that. This is, I'm going to mispronounce this probably, Plaistow in East London. And the story of Karl Hans Lodi's body, I was not able to get into that. He was buried with several other executed people in a common grave. But when the Nazis took power, they insisted that Lodi be disinterred, reinterred into his own grave. But by then, they weren't able to get his body out. There was cement over it. They couldn't really identify who it was. The British were willing to do it, but they said it's impossible. And that's why they put a tombstone. His body's not actually under there, but he's got an individual tombstone, which is still very, very rare that a foreign agent would have a tombstone in Britain, nonetheless.
I have a question about the Lusitania.
Yeah.
There was an article in the American History magazine sometime in the past year about its sinking. The author suggested that the British were complicit in its sinking, in that they knew there were German submarines in the area and they did not send out escort ships. Can you confirm? Is that a statement of fact?
I can confirm that they said that. as I said, I'm a PhD student and I'm just trying to get my career started, so I don't want to get into I don't want to get into any conspiracies, but we'll probably never know the full answer as to what really happened to the Lusitania. They still think that maybe it was a coal explosion or whatever. That's probably not true. Most historians believe it was torpedoed by Germans, and they suspected it was because of wartime munitions. Now, the other conspiracy thing about that is that it did have wartime munitions on it, and it did have gun turrets. This is a couple of things that my guy, Karl Hans Lodi, I shouldn't call him my guy, I don't really like him. My guy, Karl Hans Lodi, actually was reporting that was rumored to be. If that was the case, that's why the Germans sunk it. I got to mention this. When it came to unrestricted submarine warfare, submarines were technically, legally, in the laws of war, they were supposed to go up to merchant, non-military ships and everything, and if they wanted to sink it, they had to come out of the water and announce themselves. We're going to sink you, and give them time to get off the boats. That was the humane thing to do. What did most of the Allies, and for that matter, Germany, do? They started arming. All they need is just a few machine guns on the thing and say, yeah, we're going to surrender. They come up and they just blast that submarine away. If you're in a submarine and you lose that surprise factor, you're not effective at all. So they started sinking ships, the Lusitania being the huge example, just suspecting that they had war stuff on there. So, but yeah, it's a great topic.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm wondering where he learned such good American English.
Oh, so do I. Yeah, that's a great question. While I went to Nordhausen, where he would have went to grammar school, I wasn't able to find a lot of documents there. I will say that when it comes to Europeans, they, you know, they're so much better at learning multiple languages as us. It's really a travesty what happens with us. I know nowadays in Germany, they start learning English full-time at about third grade. So, you know, they know English before they're out of high school. They can speak it as well as anybody. I have one professor, my direct professor, Dr. Gerald Steinecker. He's from Austria, has a relatively thick accent. It's a great accent, but it's thick. And then I have another professor from Heidelberg, grew up there, and he talks, and you have to really listen. It was like, I don't know, he sounds like he's from Nebraska. So it's very curious about some of these accents. And some people just have a talent for accents. So, but that's something that I had kind of questioned. It's like, man, that's cool. I wish I could do that.
Do we know if the American whose identity he took might have suffered any consequences?
Yes, there is, and for the life of me right now, I can't remember what happened. He did complain because there was a Charles Inglis. He was an American tourist. His passport was with the Foreign Office, registered with the Foreign Office, And then he went back to get his passport, and they said, "We lost it. Sorry. Here's your emergency passport. Go on." When the actual passport then landed in Karlheinz Lodi's hands. Some historians, I can say Thomas Bogart, a military and espionage historian, has concluded that it was Lodi himself that stole that document, that stole the passport. And I definitely agree with him. He knows a lot more about that particular than I do. But yeah, Charles Inglis, he would get an emergency passport later on. The passport issue is another way that Karlheinz Lodi made history. He stole that passport, went off as Charles Inglis. How easy was it to do that? Well, there were no fingerprints and there was no photograph on the passport. How tall you are, what the color hair was, and it happened that Charles Inglis was the same height, same hair color as Karlheinz Lodi was, so he passed off on that. Because of the Lodi case, directly because of the Lodi case, they changed those rules that everybody with a passport has to have a photograph on them.
I don't remember the exact dates you said. How long did the trial last, and then what was the length of time between incarceration and put to death?
Well, I'm not going to say how long the trial lasted because I can't remember exactly, but he was arrested on October 2nd, 1914, and the court-martial was over by October 30th, or 31st, one of the two. So it was only a matter of 3 or 4 weeks, probably, that the proceedings were actually happening, perhaps even less than that. There was such a wealth of evidence, it was just about them collecting it. Again, Lodi was not very good at covering his tracks, so it was just all there. And the accused was admitting what he did and not giving up his sources. So it was a slam dunk legally from a legal standpoint what was going to happen. It was just the manner of how it was going to happen. So it happened quick, and then when he was sentenced on the 30th or 31st of October, it was 6 days later on November 6th when he was executed. Yeah. It was not announced until the 11th. They waited 5 days for the announcement.
All right. Well, thank you all for coming tonight. Thank you, Tony.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. This Saturday, November 11th, Armistice Day, is the 99th anniversary of the end of the First World War. As part of that celebration, we've heard a talk by Tony Foreman, a history PhD student at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, and advisee of Professor Gerald Steinacher. He spoke on the topic, Karlheinz Lodi, World War I German Spy and Nebraska Immigrant. This program, presented as part of the recent Top Secret License to Spy exhibit at the Durham Museum, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, August 15th, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jessica Brummer, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.